Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When a physician gives you a choice, your first impulse when it comes to your treatments is probably to ask, well, what would you do, doctor? The response depends on the science. When medical evidence is weak, physicians tend to make the patient decide, and when evidence is abundant, they make their opinions known. Dr. Dhruv Kular recently wrote about the topic for the New York Times. We'll post a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Dr. Kular is a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center for Physician Practice and Leadership. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You began your piece for the New York Times with a short blurb about you and your patient locked in a game of decision-making hot potato. Tell us, how do these types of conversations usually play out?
Well, you know, one of the things that I wanted to bring attention to is when we're having these conversations with patients, often we talk about different options as certainties. And I wanted to draw attention to how much uncertainty is in each one of the decisions that we're asking patients to make and that we're making recommendations on. And so when there's a lot of uncertainty around what the right course of action is, for instance, the example that I give in the article is the one around prostate cancer. And there's a lot of controversy in the medical literature and among medical societies about whether patients should be screened for prostate cancer with a PSA. And those are the types of conversations that often we don't have great evidence one way or another. And so doctors will say, you know, it's on the patient to decide, or you tell me what you think that you want to do, given your values. And what I wanted the point I wanted to make here was maybe it should be the opposite. When the evidence is weakest, we should play the biggest role in helping our patients decide. And when the evidence is very strong, we should do more to explore their values and see, you know, even though the evidence is strong, is treatment in line with what your values are?
I think it's interesting because it sounds so logical to me that if there's weak evidence, then what in the world is a layperson going to know that you wouldn't already know in spades? And why wouldn't you help them make the decision?
Yeah, so I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense when you look at it that way. I think the way that the kind of medical establishment or a lot of doctors think about it is our job is to evaluate the evidence and make a recommendation. If the evidence isn't great or if we just don't know, either option might be okay to go with, and therefore it's okay for the patient to play a greater role or decide kind of which way to go because we don't have great evidence to steer you one way or another. Mm-hmm. But I do think you're right in the sense that, you know, one of the quotes I have in the article from Dr. Terry Freed, who's a doctor at Yale, she says, you know, when the evidence isn't good, doctors say, okay, you decide. But if we as doctors can't reason through that decision, how can we expect our patients to? It doesn't make sense.
Is there a protocol for doctors and their decision making for patients? Is there training for what doctors are supposed to do in these circumstances?
You know, the ideal scenario is one in which we kind of probe the patient's preferences, their goals, their values, and see how those things intersect with the available evidence. There's more and more training in medical school and in residencies to do that, but I think we're still a long way from where we need to be in training doctors to, number one, accept how much uncertainty exists, and number two, convey that uncertainty in a way that patients can understand.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Dhruv Kular. He's a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center for Physician Practice and Leadership. He wrote an article for the New York Times. He wrote an opinion piece for the New York Times about this question of who decides when treatment is afoot? You know, does the doctor help you decide? Do they just give you ideas for what your choices are? Or do they, you know, and a lot of it, what Dr. Kular is saying, depends on how much they know about it. The less sure they are, the less evidence, the more risk. Doctors tend to back off more, and he thinks it should be the other way around. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Why do you think? You mentioned something as far as doctors' comfort level with the unknown, and that that's hard. They're scientists, right? They want to be sure. And if they can't be, they back fully away.
Yeah, I think, you know, people generally are very uncomfortable with uncertainty. We want to do as much as we can to reduce uncertainty and to be more sure about the decisions that we make. And I think that's particularly the case among doctors. You know, we've trained and we've studied, and one of the goals of all that education is to make confident recommendations based on what the clinical situation is and what the evidence suggests. And when we can't do that, I think it makes us very uncomfortable. And there's evidence that suggests that doctors who are more uncomfortable with uncertainty, they experience more stress at work. Mm. They're more likely to withhold information from patients. They order a lot more tests and procedures and referrals. And so it is important that just as we help patients understand how to deal with uncertainty, our medical training process is also helping doctors deal with uncertainty.
How does the language doctors use affect that conversation with patients?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so, you know, the number one thing to do is acknowledge that uncertainty exists. But number two, it's important to learn how to communicate about uncertainty. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests that how we talk about, how we present different risks really affects how people understand their risks. And so one example is that people have a much easier time understanding absolute risk rather than relative risk. So an absolute risk presentation would be something like, this medication reduces your risk from 10% to 5%. A relative risk presentation would be that it reduces your risk by 50%. And studies suggest that it's much easier for people to manipulate information in absolute risk when you tell them exactly where the risk is to begin with and where it's going down to, instead of what percent it's reduced by. So that's one thing that I would suggest. The second thing is that people are very sensitive to harms, and they're more sensitive to harms than they are to benefit. And so this has to do with the concept of risk aversion. People are mostly risk averse. And so while we all want to talk about the benefits of treatment, what good could come of it, we should actually do a lot more to tell people about the side effects, the potential harms, the potential complications. And we don't do enough to focus on that aspect of care.
How so? What do you mean? Like, say, I had a relative who went through some targeted radiation. They had mentioned briefly that it was a six months lapse before there'd be any side effects. I don't think they explained the side effects very well. We kind of took that at face value, but something like
right.
that, is that what you're talking about?
That is. And, you know, for instance, if we are prescribing a blood thinner would be a good example. So often we prescribe blood thinners to prevent risk of heart attack or to treat a stroke. And we talk a lot about how that blood thinner might prevent those bad things from happening. What we don't do enough talking about is bleeding risk. And so these things, obviously, when you have a blood thinner, it also increases your risk for bleeding. So that's another example. There's all sorts of examples. You know, every medical intervention, whether it's antibiotics or surgery, carries with it both benefit and risk. And most of the time what we're doing, which is a very natural thing to want to do, is to talk about all the benefits that could occur from it. But we don't do enough to talk about the negative things that might occur.
Is it just an emotional thing for doctors?
You know, it's in part, I think, emotional. And I think both for doctors and for patients, our emotions are very tied up into how we evaluate different risks. And so when things seem, when they touch on a nerve, so to speak, that's when it really affects our decision-making around uncertainty and around risk. But it's also kind of what I talked about earlier, was this idea of everyone wants greater certainty, even from a rational perspective. It is rational to want to understand how much uncertainty is around each decision. And so I think it's in part emotional, and I think it's in part rational.
You mentioned Dr. Terry Fried at Yale, who you quoted in your article for the New York Times. He told you that In our enthusiasm for guidelines, we overlook whether treatment is actually in line with a patient's goal. And I've been trying to wrap my brain on the idea of what a patient's goal is for a long time. What do you mean by that?
Sure. So Dr. Fried, she's a geriatrician.
I'm sorry, it's
at,
a she.
Yeah, no, okay. No problem. She's a geriatrician at Yale and the VA there. You know, I think the point that she was trying to make, and I think it's a really important point, is a lot of these guidelines suggest that when someone reaches a certain level of risk, so a good example is statins, for instance, when your risk of a heart attack at 10 years is 7.5%, we suggest starting a statin medication, something like Lipitor or Crestor. And those guidelines, they're generally produced by researchers and policymakers, but they don't have a lot of input from patients on where we should draw the line of risk. And so it's not the case that patients had a great say in whether 7.5% risk or 5.5% risk or 10% risk was one that they would want to accept. And so what we're suggesting here is that we need to do more to use these guidelines in a way that's tailored to individual patients. And so maybe for one patient, it is the case that they had a relative who had a heart attack in the past, and they're, and it's very important for them to prevent a heart disease, or that they're very concerned about that. And so they would choose to take a statin at a much lower risk, maybe 3% or 5%. It's also the case that some people just hate taking pills, and that it's very inconvenient for their daily life. It's very bothersome. They don't want to be reminded that they have this risk or that they are ill in some way. And so they might be okay with a 10% risk at over 10 years. And so what Dr. Fried is saying, and what I think is important to take away from this, is that the guidelines are important, but the guidelines need to be tailored in a very patient-centered way, and then we can do more to do that as doctors.
Can doctors use more visual aids to help people understand than they do typically?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot more being done in the space of decision aids and risk pictographs. And so these are kind of pictures or schematics that we can work through with our patients. And so it might have 100 different people on the screen, and it'll show you, you know, 10 people are at risk for a heart attack. But if you take this medicine, only 7 of those people will have a heart attack over 10 years, so 3 people didn't. And going through those types of things with patients can be effective. The issue is that those types of decision aids are available for only a certain number of conditions. And so it's not the case that for all the different clinical decisions that doctors and patients are having to make, that you can find these types of decision aids. And that's where it becomes really important to talk very clearly about the uncertainty that is in these decisions, and to probe about what the patient wants, how this treatment might fit into their particular life. There's a great program that I also highlighted in the article. It's called SCOPED, and it comes out of UCSF Medical Center. And SCOPED stands for S-C-O-P-E-D. And the acronym stands for situation. So S is for situation. The first thing is you want to help people understand what's going on. The second is C, so scoped. C is choices. And so what are all the choices? Do you have 2 choices here? Do you have 5 choices? Let's lay out all the choices. Then you go into O. So O is for objectives. And so what are your objectives here? Is your objective to live kind of as long as possible, even if that is the case that you may have a lot of side effects from this treatment? Or is it to have a higher quality of life? You want to just reduce your symptoms, even if you trade off something in the process. And then the P is people. And so who is affected? Is it just you that's affected by this decision, or is your family affected? Are your children affected? Is your spouse affected? And then E and D at the end there, those are evaluating all the choices. And then D is finally making that decision. So that's the way I think we can help people walk through kind of the situation all the way to the decision that they need to make.
And bottom line, how do you feel about people, patients, when they say, well, what would you do?
You know, I think that is a very reasonable question, because often we don't do enough to help and support people through these decisions. And I think the final result often is that question, you know, what would you do, doc? And that's quite all right for a lot of people. I think a lot of people want to kind of put the final decision with their doctors. But I think for a lot of people, that's kind of just an exasperated end to not knowing exactly what to do, not knowing what their options are. And for those people, I really think we can do more to help them understand what's going on.
Dr. Dhruv Kular, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Dhruv Kular is a physician and researcher at Weill Cornell Medicine and director of policy dissemination at the Physicians Foundation Center for Physician Practice and Leadership. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. A few years ago, the Wexner Center for the Arts at Ohio State launched a new program called Art on the Brain. The program uses art interpretation to help improve cognitive function and rehabilitate patients recovering from traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. Joining us now is Wexner Center educator for docent and teacher programs and founder of Art on the Brain, Tracy McCambridge. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, tell us about Art on the Brain. I'm sure listeners are like, what?
Yeah,
this is Wellness Wednesday, just reminding you.
Right.
Yeah, what?
Oh. Yeah, so Art on the Brain is a multi-week program. We hang out for 8 weeks, usually once a week. And I work in the galleries at the Wexner Center with people and their family members who are living with chronic effects of brain trauma of some kind. And we dig into works of art in the galleries in a very sort of intentional and deep way. We might only talk about two pieces over the course of an hour, but we really work together as a group to look at multiple perspectives about the art, which is contemporary art. So it's kind of weird sometimes, and it can kind of throw people off in the group, but that's part of what's so great about it.
Is it random that you walk around the galleries and randomly look at things, or you have specific pieces?
I have specific pieces I usually choose, and I teach it like a class. So we'll have sort of a flow through the 8 weeks where I might start with a piece that's a little bit more accessible, you know, to put people at ease. And then as we go on, I push them more and more. And we don't just stay in the galleries. We also work with contemporary dance, and I bring in a string quartet, and we work with those artists. So it's all about creating different experiences that help people to see, again, different perspectives from within the group, feel more comfortable within a place like the Wexner Center, and get them talking about things that maybe they don't see in day-to-day life that, you know, are novel, kind of.
I see that it sounds like a nice program, mm-hmm. but what's the connection between talking about art, mm-hmm. whether it's performance art or, you know, painting or fine arts,
right.
And traumatic brain injury?
Right. So when I first started, and it's shifted over time as I've run the program over the years, the goals have shifted a little bit. So when I first started, I was thinking, the idea sort of hatched for me. I was thinking about the thinking processes that happen in the gallery space. So the way that we teach in the galleries, we use an approach that's very inquiry based, and it's called social constructivism. So socially, as a group, we're constructing the meaning. anything in the gallery space. So there's no fixed lecture, there's no fixed truth around any particular piece of art. And so I realized what we're doing in the gallery space is we're really in a very intentional and slow, transparent way with visitors. We're going through the critical thinking process. And, you know, we start with the very basic question, what do you see? What's going on here? And we unpack sort of the visual inventory of what's in front of us and start to almost like solve the visual riddle that's in front of us. And so it's kind of like problem solving, and it's challenging. It's challenging. And so I began thinking, well, who could this potentially help beyond college students that come in or K-12 students who come in on tours? And so I approached contacts that I had at the Med Center, and I wanted, in this problem-solving process, I wanted family members of, you know, loved ones, people who are dealing with chronic effects of their injuries. I wanted them side by side and all participating together, because contemporary art levels the playing field. You know, at first, nobody understands it. And so the dynamic that could be there within that family, the caregiver, patient dynamic, it gets leveled out very quickly. And so, I entered the program thinking, okay, this is going to solve, you know, certain problems. And then as we got going, I realized my goals were shifting, and I noticed that community was being built and people were feeling very comfortable around others who could empathize with their situation. So if their words weren't coming to them right away, or if there was a day where it was just a struggle to even pay attention in the gallery space, which can be echoey and loud, nobody cared. You know, we were all just sort of in it together, and we were sort of creating space for each person's experience without judgment. So I began integrating in elements of mindfulness and, you know, the sort of paying attention to your experience without judgment, just noticing what's happening. So we started sort of focusing more on the sense of community that we were building together, and the sense of, okay, this stuff is weird and we don't know what's going on. Just like in life, things can be sort of challenging because you don't always know what's happening. Contemporary art can be very ambiguous, and that can be challenging. I don't always have the answers for everyone. And I will say that up front, I don't have the answers for you. We're in it together, though. We're going to make this, you know, make meaning around this piece together, and whatever you think of it is fine. So so that's where we've shifted. It's mm-hmm. more about community. And I actually have expanded the program to serve vets coming to me from the VA. And I've worked with women who've been they're part of the CATCH special dockets court program for women who've been trafficked. And so it's much more about being okay where you are, sort of embracing that ambiguity, challenging your mind, you know. But I very much focus on the fact with groups, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a doctor, we're just hanging out together. And but programs like the Vets at the WEX and the CATCH program, they bring social workers, because you never know what might trigger someone. I'm just creating space in the community for people who might otherwise not feel like they can, you know, understand or be comfortable in a gallery space.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Art on the Brain. It's a program that uses art interpretation to help improve cognitive function and help rehabilitate patients recovering from traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress disorder. My guest is Tracy McCambridge. She's Wexner Center educator for docent and teacher programs and founder of Art on the Brain. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So there's certain pieces you go to. Mm-hmm. Tell us about one of them. And how it's – what kind of conversations it started.
Yeah. Well, I'll give you an anecdote that made me realize that something really intense and interesting was going on in this program, and it helped me to sort of shift the goals of the program. So I had gone through a few weeks with my group where they knew – the routine, you know, we had gone through it enough times. They knew what was going on in the galleries and what I sort of expected of our conversation. And so I set them loose and I said, you know, go off and find a piece in this exhibition that, sort of struck you in a way. It could be negative also. Mm-hmm. You know, you can maybe not like the piece, but just find a piece that, you know, really is kind of, you know, stuck with you. And so one of my participants, he was there with his mom. He was about 19 years old, and he chose a piece that surprised me, actually. It was by an artist named Mark Bradford. It was a very subtle piece. It was really dark. You know, if you looked close, there were, you know, details and things, but it didn't stand out in the gallery space. But there were little words in it: clean living, sober living, very subtle. And he began talking about it when the group went over to his chosen piece. And he said, you know, I think this artist is dealing with addiction issues. I think this artist is trying to work on, you know, something he's dealing with through his art. I think this artist, you know, and then slowly, slowly it started coming back to him. And he started talking about his own issues with addiction that actually ended up, you know, leaving him with an injury, and which I thought was very, I was struck and I was touched by the conversation. But later his mom came to me and said, you know, he's never talked about his addiction issues with me before. He's never opened up like that before. And so the experience of talking about the art, I don't have a set agenda. I create opportunities for people to allow whatever they need to have bubble up come to the surface. And so every week looks different. And so I don't overly structure. I leave it very open, that social constructivism approach that we use. We socially construct meaning around the object. So whatever needs to come up for him, obviously something in him was ready to talk about his issues, and the work provided the anchor and the opportunity for doing that.
When you get feedback from social workers, from physicians, mm-hmm. From therapists about this, what do they see as success?
Yeah. So I've had a lot of conversations with the social workers that come with the VA and the CATCH program. And one of them said, because I'm not in social work, she said, we're providing a third space. So this is not a clinical setting, and it's not home. It's this novel, weird space where we create safety and we create a vessel for whatever needs to come forth to happen. But I don't have a checklist. I don't have benchmarks for where people need to be at any given time. And so that, she said, you know, one of the social workers said that for her was kind of noteworthy.
Well, let's take a call from Debbie in Columbus. Hi, sure. Debbie, you're on the air.
Hi. I'd just like to share that my husband has been a participant in the Art on the Brain for several sessions.
Hey, Debbie.
Hello, Tracy. And it's been a wonderful experience for both of us. For Eric, it's provided social community, meaningful life, provided joy. On a day that might be particularly blue, we go to Art on the Brain, and he comes out, and he's all smiles. Sometimes he comes out teary-eyed because it was a moving experience. But what is most important is, regardless of what the comments are made about the art or the discussion that ensues, Tracy and the other participants are always accepting of each other. So many of the comments may not be right on target, but we're just such an accepting community. We know where everyone is. As I'm sharing this right now, I'm in the car and we're pulled over and Eric's all teary-eyed because it is a meaningful thing for him to participate in, and we're just very grateful that this program is available.
Let me ask you, Debbie, and you know, I'm interested in Eric too, for that matter, is what did you think when this was proposed as an opportunity?
Because Eric and I both are graduates of OSU, we wanted to support it and try it out. It had also been recommended by a social worker that through Ohio Health that we work with, and we thought if it was recommended, we ought to give it a go. I will tell you, the first session was a kind of eye-opening to me. Tracy will know that we went into the one gallery, and it was full of light and noise and color, and I thought, ooh, someone who's brain injury, this might not be the best thing. Uh-huh. But then as we processed what was going on after we left that gallery and then sat and talked about it, everyone's experiences were so different. It was really eye-opening to me as the caregiver. So I have really appreciated the experience of seeing other people's interpretation. I'm very honest. Art, contemporary art is not my thing, but you gain a new appreciation not only of the art, but of the people who are appreciating that art and what they get out of being there.
Hmm. Wow.
And I've really enjoyed working with the other caregivers and developing that sense of community that you're not in this horrific life situation by yourself.
Wow.
There are other people that you can call on. We've exchanged phone numbers. We've had casual dinners together. It has moved beyond just going to this program.
Debbie, thank you so much for your call. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having this program.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. How do you know if someone's right for this program?
Well, I usually work with folks who are past the acute phase. I mean, they have to be able to get to the Wexner Center. Mm-hmm. They have to be able to, you know, but I help them every step of the way. So like last fall, we rented a little motorized scooter for someone who, mm-hmm. you know, mobility was sort of an issue. If we can get them there, if they can be okay sitting for an hour. I mean, some people have realized, you know, there's just too much visual stimulus going on, you know, and they have to make that decision for themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't gauge or I don't tell someone you can be here, you can't be here.
How big has the program gotten?
Well,
Debbie mentioned that Eric's been to multiple sessions.
Right,
now.
Right. I think they've been to four. Well, I usually accept a group of max 15 people. Mm-hmm. I like to keep it very intimate.
Which includes family and that kind of
it
thing?
It does. Okay. It's a very intimate group. But like I said, I've expanded audiences a little bit. But each group, and for safety of the artwork, and but mainly for intimacy of conversation and really getting to know each other, you can't build that sort of safe vessel mm-hmm. if it feels like a bunch of strangers. Mm-hmm. So yeah, we keep it pretty small. But I constantly am trying to expand. Like, for instance, for folks who are wondering, what can I do next? This summer, we're launching a program called On Pause, where we're doing mindfulness meditation in the gallery space, which will also engage the artwork. And so, you know, because I do.
It's part of Art on the Brain or
no,
different?
No, it's okay. A separate program, okay. But I feel like it will be ideal for folks who've gone through the Art on the Brain program. So I want to sort of be able, but it will be open to the OSU community.
Do you have just one session going on at any one time?
Of Art on the Brain?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I just have one group. Well, I have of specifically Art on the Brain, but in the fall I have Art on the Brain and Vets at the Wex at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So two separate groups, but one of each type of these programs going on at any given time.
And the feedback from physicians?
Well, as soon as I reassure them that I'm not trying to be a doctor, I'm not uh-huh. playing doctor.
And you're
know?
Not studying it. You're not taking data, right?
No, no. Mm-hmm. I mean, we get, of course, if I want to measure if the program is doing what I want it to do, which is just letting people have a fun, growing experience. And so we take feedback, kind of focus group sorts uh-huh. of situations. But yeah, I'm very clear with doctor. And as a matter of fact, we've had moments where I've suggested someone go visit their doctor because we were doing a sketching activity in the galleries, and she realized through this sketching activity part of her visual plane was missing. She just wasn't processing a slice of you know, the scene in front of her, and she was very upset naturally, and we, you know, were able to sort of hold her in that because everybody could empathize, you know, with her situation. But what was really amazing is because we sort of, you know, working with contemporary art, there are lots of different stories that can be told about any one object. Mm-hmm. And so we sort of as a group took that situation and helped her to see a new narrative around it. You know, this isn't a new thing that's happened to you. You probably have been, you know, not seeing that for a while, but now you've discovered it. You can take it to your doctor. You can maybe do something about it. And so it helped her to sort of turn it around. And so that's, again, and the strength of that community and us sort of being very mindful about every thing that we see and every situation that we're in together. And so, yeah, I definitely suggest that people go see their doctors. I'm not trying to fix anybody. I'm just trying to help build resilience within the group.
Tracy McCambridge, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Tracy McCambridge is the Wexner Center Educator for Docent and Teacher Programs and founder of Art on the Brain. I'm sure you can go to the Wexner Center website to learn more about it. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up. If you have a peanut allergy or somebody close to you does, you might want to stay tuned. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. About 2% of Americans suffer a peanut allergy, the most common food allergy in children. A new therapy will roll out later this year to help patients improve immunity to peanuts. Joining us now by phone from the Ohio ENT and Allergy Physicians, Dr. Roger Friedman. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ann. I'm happy to be here.
Before we get into the peanut therapy itself, tell us why peanut allergies, it says only 2%, but it feels like everybody knows somebody. It seems much greater than that.
Yeah, actually, 2% is a lot, because back when I started practice about 35 years ago, it was 0.2%. So we've had a tenfold increase in the last 35 years, and that's dramatic in medicine. It's very rare to have any sort of thing increase that much, and I think part of the issue also is that many people say they have peanut allergies, but many of them don't actually have them. And that's where you'll hear more about more people thinking they have them than do. But 2% is still significant. And more importantly, it's much higher than 2% in young children.
Why?
Probably about, well, because that's where peanut allergies develop now, is in children. So about 4 to 5% of young children have it, and over time, about 10% of those children will outgrow it. So we'll see less of it later on. And us older folks, it was an uncommon condition. You didn't know many people who had peanut allergies, and now almost everybody knows about someone who has it. And the other problem with peanut allergies is they become a bit more deadly, a little bit more dangerous, and that's concerned lots of families and schools and the like. And so consequently, we've had lots of changes in our lifestyle because of that. You know, and examples being, you know, airplanes that won't serve peanuts, and many, many preschools are for the safety of children, are peanut-free, and many older schools, you know, elementary and above, they're very concerned about that. And we have lots of protection for our children, appropriately so, but things like peanut-free tables or peanut-free classrooms and again, even many peanut-free schools.
What do we know about why the dramatic increase in the number of people with peanut allergies?
That's the $64 billion question.
Okay.
But we think it has to do with what we call the hygiene hypothesis. And the hygiene hypothesis is different than what people think. When you're born, you're either born as what we call a T helper 1 person or a T helper 2 person. We call that TH1 or TH2. And if you're a TH2 person, you're going to become allergic. So that's, and maybe about 30 to 40% of the population is born that way. If you're born as a TH1 person, then you're not going to become allergic. And when you're a TH1 person, you make some very special chemicals in your body called gamma interferon. And gamma interferon is very important to fight off infections in babies. And those infections that gamma interferon fights off are things like measles and mumps and rubella and hepatitis and malaria and something called endotoxin. Endotoxin, we find it in farm animal poop. All right. So if you're a TH1 person, you're going to be safe. If you're a TH2 person, you don't make much gamma interferon. And so if you're exposed to those things early in life, things are going to go badly for you as far as infection. But the immune system is dynamic and can change. And so if you're exposed to those bad and evil things early in life, all right, and you're a TH2 person, you were going to be in trouble, but the immune system changes you to a TH1 system. So millions and millions of babies in the past who were born to be allergic, and especially born to be allergic to peanuts, became non-allergic because they were exposed to all those nasty things. As you know now, very happily, we have immunizations to prevent measles, to prevent chickenpox, to prevent tetanus and things like that. But as an unintended consequence, one of the only bad things about immunizations, because there have been life-changing and wonderful, but more people who are born allergic stay allergic. So we end up with more allergic people because we end up with healthier babies.
Interesting. Tell us about the new peanut therapy. What does it do?
Well, let me talk about the two parts.
Okay.
The first part, the real exciting thing is now through what we call the LEAP protocol and LEAP on protocol, is we now have a way to prevent the development of peanut allergies. And that is one of the most life-changing and dramatic changing facts in medicine we've had, frankly, in the last 20, 30 years. And what we've been able to demonstrate is that if we know a baby is at high risk of developing peanut allergies, and those include a number of groups of babies. Number one is if they have severe eczema.
Hmm.
Number two is if early in life they have egg allergy. And if number three, they come from a family that has a high chance of them developing peanut allergies. In other words, let's say their siblings have peanut allergies or potentially their mother or father have peanut allergies. Then what we do with those babies is we identify them early, again, as potential peanut allergic baby, and we have them see their allergist or their pediatrician, but usually they're going to need to see their allergist at some point, and we allergy test them in the first 4 to 6 months of life. Now, this is a very big change in how we manage allergies.
Hmm.
And if we find out that in the first 4 to 6 months of life, they have not yet become allergic to peanut butter, we start feeding them peanut butter on a daily basis.
Hmm.
And by giving them basically a teaspoon of peanut butter every day from 6 months to 5 years, we can decrease their chance of developing peanut allergies by 85%. So that's a totally revolutionary idea and dramatic change in what we've been telling moms and babies and doctors for, frankly, the last 10 years. We've been oftentimes recommending the opposite, to avoid eating peanut butter. But if we can prove that at 4 to 6 months of age they're not allergic, putting them on peanut butter can prevent them from becoming allergic.
What's the second therapy?
So what we're now studying, and this is important.
Oh, okay.
These are studies that are ongoing and have not yet been approved, but there are two studies that have been fast-tracked, meaning the FDA thinks they're very important. And two studies which have just finished up their phase 3 trials, which means, again, they've studied them in hundreds of babies and hundreds of children and hundreds of adults. And they've been able to show that, number one, using a patch, what's called an epicutaneous patch, basically like a Band-Aid with peanut butter on it, that if you put them, that you have someone who's already allergic to peanut butter and give them this Band-Aid of peanut butter daily and change it, that over time, we're able to make those patients much less allergic. Now, the patch by itself probably doesn't cure many patients, but it makes them less allergic and safer. And
the peanuts are less deadly.
Less deadly. So that if they, by mistake, eat a small quantity of peanut, they're less likely to have a severe reaction. They're less likely to need to use their EpiPen, although they may still need their EpiPen or their IVQ epinephrine injectors at some point, but it's clear that they're going to make them less allergic and safer. And that's going to be totally revolutionary for our families. We have so many families. But we have so many families who live in deadly fear of their children eating peanut butter.
Well, because of that deadly fear part piece, are people good? What is your sense about how willing people are going to be to subjecting their children to this?
Oh, no, that's a great question. And that's why, again, this has not yet been approved. It's been working. The studies are ongoing through the FDA. We've been involved with some of these study groups and have lots of knowledge about where we are. And we're not going to let this be approved. The FDA will not until it is incredibly safe. So with the patch, I think the danger will be virtually zero. Now, there's no, you know, there's nothing at zero. Mm-hmm. The second group of studies are what we call OIT, or oral immunotherapy. Now, with that, you're going to be giving the patient minuscule quantities of it orally. Now, that obviously is going to have a little bit more danger to it because you are going to be giving them peanuts. But we're working now on a schedule and the way to do it so that it also will be safe. And again, most of these studies, when we first start the patient on their therapy, will be done in a doctor's office or in a hospital setting.
Why, when with people who have peanut therapies, do they, is it tend to be, you know, you see it on the boxes and stuff saying this cereal was produced in a facility that processes tree nuts. I mean, mm-hmm. what's the right. difference?
Okay, so and that's a tough question to answer, too, because most of the time, to be honest, most of the time when it says process in a place or same equipment, most of the time those are more legal than true medical.
Okay.
Most of the time there's going to be virtually zero peanut or tree nut products in things that are processed. The very good companies that manufacture food take this very seriously, and before they would start a new process, they will totally clean those machines, and the chance of them having a quantity of peanut nut or tree nut on them that could cause harm, again, is almost zero. So if it says process in a plant, there's usually very little problem. Now, if it says this may contain peanuts, then mm-hmm. you've got to take them at their word, and we're going to have to avoid it. But mm-hmm. in general, the processing is usually going to be safe. Again, some of our families will elect to just avoid those, and that's certainly not unreasonable if they want to. But many of our families know that they can eat products that have been processed in the same, it gets sometimes ridiculous, processed in the same country as something. So mm-hmm. you've just got to be careful, but know that there's very little danger in those situations.
Why are peanuts so dangerous? I mean, I have an allergy to leaf mold. It's not going to kill me.
No, it's not. And we've got a couple of, again, theories about this. One of the problems with peanuts is the fact that they are very peanuts and tree nuts, when they're eaten, happen to be very sticky. And so they oftentimes stick near the top of the lower part of the throat. And when you have an allergic reaction, one of the things that happens, the most deadly thing that happens to you, is if your throat closes up. And so if the food stays right on the throat and the allergic reaction is occurring in the throat, you're more likely to have a bad outcome. That's one of the reasons. And they also just happen to, the body, for reasons that we don't know, makes such a robust response against peanuts that it causes so many more problems.
Another question is something, and we're running out of time, but you said it at the beginning that a lot of people say they have a peanut allergy when they don't. Why in the world would somebody say that if they don't have it?
So, yeah, here's what our dilemma is and what our problem is. You know, a lot of good physicians out there are worried about nut allergies, and parents will ask them questions about, could my child have peanut allergies or tree nut allergies? And sometimes what they'll do is they'll send a blood test off to look and see whether they're allergic. Uh-huh. And the problem is that the blood test for food allergies, if there's no history of ingesting the food and having a problem, the blood tests are incredibly inaccurate.
Okay.
In other words, they'll give false positives. And so many times the primary care physician will say, I sent off the blood and it says you're allergic to peanuts. And it turns out many times those patients are already eating peanuts without a problem. But because they get that false positive, they're told to stop eating the peanuts.
So I guess the moral of that story is see an allergist.
I think you need to see a specialist in food allergies.
Okay.
And usually that's going to be an allergist or a good primary care doctor.
Dr. Roger Friedman, thanks for joining us.
It's been my pleasure, Ann. Have a great day.
You too. Dr. Roger Friedman with the Ohio ENT and Allergy Physicians. That's it for Wellness Wednesday. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.